The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are on Stitcher. We're on Amazon Podcasts, other podcast platforms. We would love it if you subscribe. We'd love it even more if you're so inclined. If you leave us a review, we are under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter at WOWKUCIFM. We're on Facebook, Writers on Writing KUCI, and we both have websites. Barbara's is penonfire.com. Mine is Marie Stone, M-A-R-R-I-E Stone.com. You can't miss us. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. We're getting back into journalism and narrative nonfiction today, and what a narrative nonfiction book we have. Robert Kolker is the author of Lost Girls, a New York Times bestseller and New York Times notable book, and one of Slate's best nonfiction books of the quarter century. He is a National Magazine Award finalist whose journalism has appeared in New York Magazine, The New York Times Magazine, Bloomberg Businessweek, Wired, O, The Oprah Magazine, and The Marshall Project. His latest, published in April of last year and now out in paperback, is Hidden Valley Road. It was a nonfiction instant number one New York Times bestseller and selection of Oprah's Book Club. It was named the top 10 book of the year by the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and Slate. One of the year's best by NPR, the Boston Globe, the New York Post, and Amazon. And number one book of the year by People Magazine and one of President Barack Obama's favorite books of 2020. The paperback is published by Vintage Anchor Books, and it is the subject of our chat this morning. Bob, welcome.
Thank you so much for talking with me, Mary. I really appreciate it.
I was blown away by this. You know, I always feel tremendous sympathy for authors who had books out last March and April as the world was falling apart, and God, so many books just kind of died on the vine. But that was not a problem for this book. It did so well. Congratulations.
Thank you. I was really stunned. A difficult publishing year to be sure, but the book was really, it was rescued by Oprah Winfrey, first of all, and it was selected for the book club. But then it got, the reviews all seemed to support the idea that it was a well-intentioned book, because so many bad things happened in it. The concern was that it might be seen as exploitative, and I was really relieved to see that it wasn't.
Yeah, and I think we can get into this a little later, but I think you really touched on something. You know, first of all, it was a compelling narrative, as we'll get into, but also I think there's just some universal fears and something so visceral about the subject matter that really would draw a universal reader in, even though the book was so specific and surprising. So, but we can get into all of that. So let's start with the book itself, in case some folks out there aren't familiar with the story or its subject matter, and then maybe we can work backwards to how you found this family and how you became the right man to tell this story based on your background. Can you take us inside the Galvin family and kind of set the stage for the saga?
Sure. The Galvins were a mid-century American family with 12 children. They lived in central Colorado in Colorado Springs. Dad worked for the Air Force. He was an instructor at the Air Force Academy, and he flew the Falcons at the football games. And mom was a cultured New Yorker who was sort of dragged out west to support her husband and his career. They end up having 12 children and really become sort of a model family. They're very well known because there's so many kids. Everybody's really good looking and accomplished. They all fly Falcons everywhere. The oldest is born in 1945, the youngest in 1965. So it's the baby boom personified. They're really the all-American family in many ways. But then in the late 60s, the first of six of the 12 has a psychotic break. And by 1980, six of the 12 have been diagnosed with schizophrenia. It's just a complete collapse of the family at a time when schizophrenia and severe mental illness was even less understood than it is now. Yeah. And so the book sort of trails the family story as a multi-generational family saga, like narrative nonfiction. And it weaves in the science of schizophrenia as sort of a second track in the book. Just enough so that you understand the stakes for the family and you understand what others like the Galvins were facing too.
It's amazing. I've heard you say that you didn't have a tremendous science background, and the science in this really was really compelling. I almost thought maybe it was helpful to not have a science background because you could approach it the same way your average reader would approach it, and you could explain things on that level much easier. But I don't know how you found that part of the book for yourself to grapple with the scientific research issues.
The book for me was a real mix of familiar and unfamiliar, because I, for much of my career, have really spent a lot of time interviewing people who are in crisis and entire families in crisis and told their stories. Usually it's people who've been through a really amazing emotional journey, and I try to faithfully and sensitively tell that story. But the science part of this, yes, it was entirely new to me. And I trained as a generalist. I had 15 years at New York Magazine writing feature and cover stories. And so diving into something unfamiliar is something I'm accustomed to, but this was especially intimidating. Schizophrenia is not well understood, even by people who study it. And I think you're right. I think one thing that did help me was I had a sort of layman's impatience with the material. I started by trying to listen to some neurobiology lectures on YouTube or whatever. And 5 minutes in, I said, I can't do this. I can't dial into it this way. And so I eventually found the way to do it would be as a narrative, as a human story. And it's a story of conflicting philosophies and agendas. And it's a political story of various sections of the psychotherapeutic community and the biological community and the research community, all sort of disagreeing with each other and stifling progress for many, many years. And of course, then I have to go back and check my work and make sure that I'm not just dialing into it because it's fun. I have to make sure that it's accurate as well. And I'd say that, 80% of the stress of this book was making sure that it was scientifically accurate.
It's amazing that this family kind of came up along the time the research was coming up, that those timelines really ran in parallel to each other as things were being understood and discoveries were being made. And the notion that you've talked about before, that schizophrenia, first of all, it's not that common. It's so generally misunderstood. I had so many misconceptions about it. And so it's not really that well funded, and there aren't a ton of subjects for it. So all of that, as opposed to some other mental illnesses, seems like it's really working against it. But good advances being made, though.
Yes. So much about it surprised me, though. It's not really an illness in and of itself, the way that, say, COVID-19 is an illness. It's a syndrome. It's a name we give for a lot of symptoms. And so in that case, it's not a cookie cutter condition. One of the Galvin boys had delusions. Another had hallucinations. The list goes on. One was more catatonic. One was more animated. They all had the same diagnosis, but they were different people and with different experiences. And that was eye-opening to me. The other thing is that in our lifetimes, I think these psychiatric disorders get thought of as brain chemistry issues, that if you find the right prescription, the right miracle drug, and work hard through trial and error and also therapy, that you can really have an impact in really changing your life for the better. But schizophrenia really isn't like that. Anxiety and depression and bipolar disorder are certainly like that. But for schizophrenia, they're using the same drugs that the Galvins had in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And that was really eye-opening to me too. And the reason was what you said, Mary. It's that as a constituency, people with schizophrenia can't really or aren't really able to campaign for progress the way that, say, people with prostate cancer or breast cancer do.
I wonder if it's almost best understood like cancer, because cancer really is, like you say, it's not one thing. It's a twist of, I don't know. Now, as I'm talking it out, the analogy isn't quite right, but it's a cluster of problems rather than one thing to be understood in one way. That was really illuminating to me in this book.
Yes. And the one really powerful analogy that I got from one source was to think of it the way that maybe people used to think of what a fever was hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
Hundreds of years ago, a fever was a disease. Like, oh, they got a fever. What are we going to do about the fever? But now we know that the fever isn't the disease. It's a symptom of what could be a dozen different things.
Right.
An infection, a virus, you just don't know. And so it's possible that 30 or 40 years from now, what we call schizophrenia may actually be a dozen different discrete brain conditions, each one at a different stage of being treated in different ways, the same way cancer is. So the analogy holds for cancer in that respect too.
Whew, thank God. So talk about finding this family and finding this story. I think that is one of the hardest things for journalists to seek out the right story, knowing the elements are going to make it hold together. And so tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I usually say no a lot.
I'll bet you do. Yeah.
I was introduced to the two youngest siblings in the family, who were the only females, the two sisters, Lindsay and Margaret, in early 2016. And the person who introduced them was a mutual friend of ours, my good friend, John Gluck, who edited me at New York Magazine for many years. We both had left New York and were working at different places, but we're still good friends. John grew up with the Galvins. He went to high school with Lindsay and then got to know the family over time. And he, you know, in time, he got to know the gist of their story. The sisters came to him in 2015 or 2016, and they said, we've been thinking for years, especially Margaret had been thinking for years about the best way to tell the family story, to let the world know about the story. Not just their family travails, but also the scientific progress that perhaps the family could be credited with. They felt it could be an inspiring story despite everything sad that had happened to the family. And John thought of me immediately because he felt I'd be a good match for the material. My previous book, Lost Girls, was about five different families that had been through misfortune. I had been doing lots of reporting at New York Magazine about other families in distress. So it seemed like one way or another, my kind of thing. But when I talked to them, I could not have been more shocked. It's not just schizophrenia. There's sexual abuse. There's clergy abuse. There's a murder-suicide. It seemed like everything possible happened to this family. And I couldn't believe it could all just happen to one family. And I couldn't believe the family was still together, that they could even call themselves a family. And I didn't know what story to tell. Is it the sister's story of how they made it through? Is it a science case study of a story about a family with a lot of mental illness? Is the hero of the book a researcher? Is it the story of the parents? And finally, after many, many months of talking with everyone in the family and being reassured that they all were ready to go public, I realized I could potentially do it all, that this could be a very special book, not just one thing, but more of an epic multi-generational family saga and a medical mystery.
Well, that answers so many of my questions, because I thought, God, you just had an avalanche of material coming at you, and understanding how to organize that. And as you say, what story to tell and how to tell it would have been really, I think, really difficult. So you sat with this family. You kind of let this stuff percolate as you sat with this family for maybe months. I don't know how long, until you understood the shape of it and kind of could get above it to see how many different layers you could layer on top of the saga. Is that how it kind of came about?
Yes, it took a little more than a year from that first phone call with Lindsay and Margaret to the time when I sent a thorough book proposal out to publishers and sold the book. Okay. And in that year, I had so many concerns. The first was that everyone in the family would be interested in talking. And we know there are medical privacy laws in America. All it would take is one family member to try to object to what was going on.
Right.
And then I was worried that I wouldn't be able to write about mental illness in a way that really would be helpful to anyone. I didn't want to write about these sick brothers as monsters or as pod people or as special mystical fanciful creatures. I wanted to write about them as people. And when I met the three surviving brothers, that worry went away almost immediately. I saw how they were very obviously compromised at this stage in their lives, but very charming and interesting and very much their own people in their way. And that helped me a lot.
So,
and I worried that the science wouldn't be, you know, the science wouldn't be legible, that there wouldn't be anything really to say except how hard it all is. And when I spoke with researchers, that helped me gain confidence there as well.
You spoke with the brothers who are currently sick as well. I mean, talk about the perfect unreliable narrator, right? you'd have to kind of suss out how much of their story is reliable to tell from their point of view, empathetically and objectively, and get their take on things. Because the thing that really struck me about this book is there's never any good guys or bad guys. There's a lot of good and bad that happen. And there's, you know, a lot of angels and demons in all of these characters. But your level of both journalistic detachment and incredible empathy for telling the whole well-rounded story was remarkable. And I don't know if that was a struggle for you, or if, you know, you found yourself siding with people at certain points in trying to tell the story.
Well, the good thing about what I do is that there are a lot of great models out there to sort of think of as you go forward. They're the Michael Lewis's and David Grands and, you know, Catherine Boo and Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc. These are people who write book length narrative nonfiction books that read like novels, but tell compelling stories, but also get across very complicated issues. And so I knew that I wanted to do something like that. And part of the job of that is to be sensitive and insightful, but not necessarily flip over into advocacy, not to sit there and be a crusader pounding the drum for one thing or another, because then you potentially lose credibility. So I think what you said is quite right. I needed to be impartial the way a journalist is, but also very, very close to the emotional life of all the people in this family so that I represented them accurately. And that meant not being a judge and jury. That meant displaying everybody's rationale in as clear a way as possible. But I wasn't there to weigh in and say, well, she was right, and obviously he was wrong. I wanted to do something a little more, you know, a little deeper than that.
It's remarkable you found them when you did, because you found them right before Mimi, who was the matriarch of the family, passed away in 2017. The brothers, you know, at least the three that are still sick, it sounds like they were still able to talk with you and communicate and are active. And if you'd found them earlier, it's not clear to me that they would have been willing to share the story. You know, you would have had, I think, maybe for Mimi at least, some more resistance about telling the story. So it sounds like things kind of aligned at just the right time for you to tell this tale.
The sisters and then many of their brothers did feel a certain amount of pressure, because Mimi was very frail and over 90 and experiencing lots of health issues, even though she was very sharp. And then Mimi, who might have opposed such a thing just a few years earlier, she was feeling up to it as well, because there had been some recent scientific progress with two different teams of researchers that had met the Galvins back in the 80s. So she could point to their work and be slightly vindicated and energized by what they were doing. She felt like the book could have a happy ending that way. And mm-hmm. So where she might've said yes just a few years earlier, she said yes now.
Because she was so invested all the way through in this perfect family narrative and in secrecy and covering for her sons, who were wreaking a lot of havoc for some of her other children. As you say, there's everything in this story. There's sexual abuse, clergy abuse. You kind of went through the litany. And I think that makes it so accessible, is not the right word, but so universal for so many readers, that they can enter the book on their own terms and come to understand and see themselves and their own family dynamic in that. So the specificity of this book really had a universal flair. And I don't know if that was conscious on your part in your work in journalism to understand how these themes can be felt so universally amongst the audience, but I think that's how it read. I mean, it seems like that's how it's having such a giant life in so many people's psyches.
I think, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but when I look at a lot of the things I've written, often I'd been assigned them, you know, for magazines because something bad has happened. But really the point of the story wouldn't be necessarily to detail every last grisly detail of the bad thing that had happened. It would be to talk about what happened next and then what happened after that and what the ripple effects of that are and how people moved through that trauma. And also the stuff that happened before, like what led up to that. To get sort of around it a little bit so that you feel like you're processing the trauma along with those characters. And by characters, I mean actual people, not storybook characters. and that's the job, I think, in a book like this as well, is to not just make it about rubbernecking and looking at one family's misfortune, but almost using the family as an example of how people move through life when the worst possible things happen, and what happens to them next, what happens to them after that, and what about after that. And that was the privilege of being able to report on the Galvins, who were so kind to be open with me about it. I could talk about what Lindsay or Margaret felt about this family at the age of 9 and at 19 and at 29, 39 and 49, and see how everything changed over time. And I had a big enough book to be able to do it in a way that made sense. So it was just a thrill and a challenge at the same time.
And it's not, I mean, for all of those themes, it didn't feel overwhelmingly dark. Like it felt like they did have moments of, you know, being a happy family, and they played tennis together. They had this falconry, which I want to get into in a minute. But lest we leave readers with the impression that it was so heavy as to be impenetrable, they had a lot of affection for each other. They still have a lot of affection for each other. So, and that really came through. And I don't know how, you know, if you had a difficult time finding light in the dark so the reader didn't get too overwhelmed.
These are very bright and, you know, people with a lot of insight into themselves. I mean, they obviously are traumatized by what happened, and they all feel like they're walking on eggshells to one extent or another. It's a pleasure being around them because they do have a lot of perspective. They have sort of lived it. And so I wanted to get that across in the book as much as I could. I didn't want it to just be a parade of misery. I wanted to show what the stakes were, because the family did have a lot to offer. There were good times. It was exciting being a Galvin back in the 1950s to 1960s. And when things start to go bad, hopefully the reader understands what's at stake, that everything that's good about the family is hanging in the balance because of how the bad things are starting to happen. And again, just to underscore it, nobody understands why those things are happening. I mean, they're testing the water. They're wondering if maybe vitamins are the answer. The doctors are blaming bad parenting. There's just bad idea after bad idea being thrown at them.
Right. And because it's manifesting in different ways in different boys, and they aren't kind of chronologically falling apart, kind of roughly chronologically, but not quite chronologically. So yeah, you have to be wondering. I mean, there are so many elements in the mix with 12 children being crammed into a relatively, it sounds like, kind of small house in a ton of bunk beds. You know, what would that do to a family? And what do 12 children do to a family? And, you know, all of these pressures, the academic pressures that it sounds like both their parents were kind of thrusting upon them. Maybe that had something to do with it. So yeah, there were a lot of reasons that you could wonder, maybe it's something else, or justify it away until it got so extreme that you kind of couldn't ignore what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's rock and roll, or maybe it's drugs. Remember, it's the late 60s or early 70s.
Right.
There's one son who blames the parents for being too suppressive. And then the parents at some point wonder if maybe they're too permissive. The country is sort of imploding too at the time that the family is falling apart. And so there's that layer going on as well. At the very beginning, when listening to the two sisters talk about their family, I did think a lot about American Pastoral, the Philip Roth novel, where this golden family implodes at around the same time that the Galvins did.
So I both read the book and listened to the audio. I'm going to give a little shout out to the audio reader, who was fantastic.
But I'm really lucky about him. He's great. Sean Pratt is wonderful. He, as it turned out, he read my first book, Lost Girls, and he got compliments. I kept hearing, you know, your book is a really good reader. And then when it came time for this book, they said, do you have anyone in mind? And I said, well, is he available? He did a good job with the last one. And he's won awards for it. And he really deserves it.
Fantastic. And it would have been very easy, I think, with the number of characters, the level of detail, all of it, to get lost either reading it or get lost listening to it. And you just never did. But in reading it, a very clever idea you had at the beginning of every chapter was to list the cast of characters in the family. Characters are real people. And then kind of highlight who you were going to be talking about, which was a great way to follow along that way. But yeah, with him as a reader, you absolutely never got lost. And then at the beginning, there's this really nice roadmap of people and, you know, their birth dates and death dates and whatnot, so you could follow along.
It's certainly what you crave when you read a big book with lots of people in it.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
If you sit and read War and Peace, you think, boy, it'd be nice to have a chart just to see, just to yes. be able to glance over. And
right.
So when I thought of the idea of having everybody's name at the top of every chapter and then highlighting who was sort of up at bat for this chapter to be focused on, I really got excited because I thought, wow, this could really make a huge difference for a lot of readers.
Huge difference. Yeah. It was really remarkable to me as I moved through the book to realize I know exactly what's going on at every time. So in terms of organizing the material in your office, you know, you, I imagine, have reams of interviews. I don't know if you recorded them or you jotted notes as you were doing them. I imagine you have reams of research material and books on schizophrenia, however you do that. Talk a little bit about organizing the material. If you were researching as you were writing, kind of how you kept this balance, or if you kind of had to have the structure of the book in your head and then you slotted things in as you needed them. Tell me a little bit about that.
I started with the idea that the book would have two parts. and that the first part would end when things seem at their absolute bleakest for the family. Okay. When the murder-suicide has happened, the father's health is compromised, and one of the sisters has to leave home and go live somewhere else, and the other sister feels abandoned because of it. And it's like this great cliffhanger of a moment. And this happens in the mid-70s. And then the second part would take you beyond that as the children all grow up and start to renegotiate their relationships with the family and see their parents in new eyes. And of course, there are scientific breakthroughs as well. And one thing I had in mind was that the scientific researchers who study the family, they wouldn't show up until the beginning of part two, almost like a murder mystery where in the middle of the story, the detective shows up, you know, out of nowhere and says, I'm going to try and find out what happened. So that was very general. But then I kept two really, really detailed timelines. One would be a family timeline starting with earlier generations and continuing at a very granular way, not a name and date, not a so-and-so graduates high school timeline, but a long paragraphs of interview transcript about a certain moment or an episode. So the documents would start to get very, very long. And then the second similar timeline for the science of schizophrenia, starting with its first getting named in 1903, and even before that when it went under a different name, and then the different debates between Freud and Jung, and then suddenly the debates about bad mothering in the 1940s, like trying to do it chronologically so that it reads as a story. And then looking at those two timelines, I started to try and think of ways of weaving the science in, and that became a major chore, particularly in revision, because I think we nonfiction writers often get a little too in love with our research, and we don't want to throw anything out. We want all the readers to know all the hard work we did and look at what I learned about schizophrenia. So I kind of made a rule in the revision to try and tightly rein in these passages about the science so that they really were only about raising the stakes for the Galvin family and helping you understand why the Galvins were in the situation they were in at this particular moment. And that anything beyond that was just going to feel like homework to the reader. So that was my decision later on.
I'm trying to think when movies like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Sybil and some of those films came out, because I'm just mentally playing along with Mimi's headspace about seeing how terrifying, you know, sending your sons off to one of these mental institutions would be with these images in your head of what happens behind those doors.
There are some TV exposés and documentary exposés about these state mental hospitals that came out in the 60s, around the same time that the first son has his psychotic break. So yes, you're absolutely mm-hmm. right. The idea of sending that son to a state mental hospital felt would be a real no-go for her, because it would just seem like a complete horror show. And that was really in the culture. And One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was published in 1962. I think the movie was in the 70s, but it was in the culture and people understood it. And in fact, Donald, the oldest son, ended up in Oregon at the same medical facility for a short time. And he would brag to people saying, oh, I was at the Cuckoo's Nest. But so it was part of the culture as well. It's a complicated thing, because One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is really a social novel about oppression and about conformism and about authority crushing free spirit. It's really not about schizophrenia.
Yeah. Right.
And yet it's how a lot of people process the idea of mental illness for many years.
Well, the images were so terrifying that I think they just got seared on our brains. I was young when I saw it. So I think, I was probably taking away the wrong message. My guest this morning is Robert Kolker, the book Hidden Valley Road, Inside the Mind of an American Family. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You had talked a little bit in the acknowledgments or the end section about different dead ends and snafus and storytelling snarls that you ran into with the book, working your way out of them. I'd love to know, you know, what some of those were and how you backed out of the problems.
Well, there was one very early on where I had assumed, because I had spoken with the sisters together, that this would be a story about two girls leaning on each other and helping each other their entire lives. And then once I started to interview them separately, I saw that they each had very, very different approaches to their family and opinions about their family. And that at times they had actually had long falling outs with each other about this. And that kind of distressed me for a little while. And then I kind of sat up straight and thought, wait a minute, this is how families are. You know, children don't process their family memories the same way as their siblings do. I know I say this a lot, but you know, I have a brother and a sister, and I'm sure our memories of our family growing up are all very self-serving and contradictory at times to what the other people's memories are. And so it's here was a chance to, this qualified as a storytelling snarl for sure, but tackling it actually would make it a much better book, because one sister doesn't have to be right and the other one doesn't have to be wrong. Like, getting both of their approaches and their rationales in there makes for a way better book. I mean, I've had readers come to me and say, some days I agree with one sister and other days I agree with the other sister. It just depends on how I'm feeling about my family. And I think that that's a real credit to the way it fits into the broader story of the family.
I should mention that if you go online, there are ways you can meet both of these sisters on Zoom events that you did last year. I don't know if they're doing any events with you for the paperback release, but you can see the sisters and you can hear a few things in their own words. And that, you know, to give current visualization to who they were was kind of fun and interesting. And I think even Lindsay's daughter appears in one of the videos too. So you can follow the generations down. Were there inconvenient truths that you stumbled upon as you were doing either the biological research or the family research, something that you had a narrative in mind? And I guess one of these would be what we were just talking about, but something that kind of derailed the story where you were like, ugh, I wish I hadn't uncovered that, because it kind of messes with whatever the story was I was trying to tell, and then having to reconstruct what you were doing.
There were big things facing me at the very beginning that I knew were going to be trouble from the start. The first was the stereotype that severely mentally ill people are violent is exactly that. It's a stereotype. I mean, the numbers don't bear out. They're more prone to be victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators of violence. And yet in the media, we see them as being, you know, it's all the violent cases all get a lot of attention. And this book has nothing but violence. And so I was worried that it would fall into that trap. So I needed to be sensitive to that. And then in the same vein, there is one brother, Jim, whose rationale is impossible to get behind because he's sexually abusive to both sisters for many, many years. And I didn't want at all to suggest that schizophrenia causes pedophilia. And mm-hmm. There's no research to support it. And so I had to be very careful and make sure that I said it explicitly, like twice in the book, that there's no connecting the two. So those were going to be big issues no matter what I did. And the best I could do is just sort of be mindful of them at every turn. And more broadly, you know, there are people out there reading this book who have mental illness in their family or might have mental illness themselves. And I didn't want them to feel objectified or made to feel like the other. I wanted this to be a book that everybody would be comfortable reading. I didn't want it to be a monster movie where, or like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or something, where one by one it comes for the family and who will be next. I didn't want to play it that way. I felt like there was going to be enough power in what exactly happened without me having to play it that way.
It almost makes you wonder if by the sheer number of family members is what brought down so many of the issues, because as you say, there's no connection between pedophilia and schizophrenia, but we had to deal with that. The father has a stroke and that obviously has no connection to anything else. It's just bad luck. So you wonder, okay, if you get 14 people under the same roof, just a certain amount of good and bad luck are going to happen to them. And by the number of people, you're going to have all of these issues. I don't know if that's how you came away thinking of it, or if, you know, this family was just blessed and cursed. I don't know.
I think that's fair. I mean, if you have a son like Jim, who's, you know, sexually abusive to the sisters, if there had only been three children in the family, Jim and the two sisters, they probably could have stayed away from him.
Yeah.
But because there was so much else going on in the house, so much chaos, and the girls needed somewhere to be to get away from other things that were going on, it was very easy for Jim to say, oh, I'll take them on the weekend. And that would be that. So yeah, I think the numbers, there are readers who have read the book and said, you know, this begins and ends with the idea of there being 12 children, that there just weren't enough eyes on what was going on, and that it was so much worse because of the numbers. And that's one way of looking at it for sure.
Let's talk about the gift of falconry, because this was such a wonderful metaphor. And I don't know if you ever considered quoting the Yeats poem that is so perfectly mapped on. The first stanza of that poem is so perfectly mapped onto this book. But I love these gifts that writers are just given. And I don't know if you saw that as a gift, or you just can, you know, your writer's eye can turn kind of any detail into the right metaphor. But first of all, talk about their obsession with falconry, I guess, so people know what we're talking about. But then how you were able to weave that in as just the perfect metaphor for this family.
It's funny you mentioned that line in poetry, because there's a wonderful schizophrenia memoir by Alan Sachs called The Center Cannot Hold. Mm-hmm. So it's another line from the same poem.
Yeah, right.
But the family's famous. The Don and Mimi, the parents, were the first to suggest that the US Air Force would make the Falcon their mascot. That's when the Air Force was breaking off from the Army and becoming their own thing after World War II. And in the years that the family was affiliated with the Air Force Academy, they were the Falcon people. You know, Don ran the training program for the cadets, and he flew the Falcons at football games, and he traveled the country, and he was on national television flying Falcons. And so this was their fame. And the older kids in the family, they were assistant falconers and flew birds themselves. And they had birds in the house. They had a bird on the coffee table in the parlor. So, and then a muse in the backyard. It was a thing. And of course, for storytelling purposes, it was an amazing thing, because this is not golf, you know, it's a very demanding hobby. It's the kind of thing where you have to domesticate a wild animal and work really, really hard to do it. And it gives you a lot of confidence if you do it right. And so the Don and Mimi Galvin, the parents, came away supremely confident in their abilities after becoming so accomplished at falconry. And they probably felt the same way about raising kids for many, many years. They felt, well, if you do everything right and you're very, very disciplined, good things will happen to you. And the book really is about what happens when unforeseen bad things happen, despite thinking you've done everything right.
So I think one of the most difficult part, well, I don't know, there's so many difficult parts, but I think one of the hard parts is getting in and getting out of the book. And so this provided you, I think it's a hawk at the beginning and not a falcon, but this provided you with, there's this image that the book opens with of Mimi sewing this bird's eyes shut. The bird is alive. I think it's a hawk, and she has to sew his eyes shut for trust reasons, I think, right? Or to train a part of this training. And so I just thought, you know, the reader is just immediately hooked. I mean, you read that and you just can't wait to hear what the hell is happening next. So that falconry, I don't know at what point that became sort of a guiding principle that you said, I can just weave this through the entire book as sort of a touchstone that I can keep narratively coming back to. And then finding that as a way into the story itself. I don't know how many passes you took at trying to find a way into the story to start the book.
A storytelling device like that, as far as I'm concerned, with a nonfiction book, it's a little like salt when you're cooking. Like at a certain point, there's too much. You got to be very careful not to put too much salt in. So I certainly run with it hard at the beginning, but then only a tiny little. I try not to hit the gas on it too much later on, because a little goes a long way.
Right.
That moment with the sewing the eyelid shut is fascinating to me, as someone who didn't know anything about falconry beforehand.
Yeah.
Apparently, you know, the reason why they have those little hoods for hawks and falcons is that it makes the hawk or the bird dependent on the person who's training them. It's almost like a Stockholm syndrome develops, where they grow to love their captor. And if you want to do it the way they did it hundreds of years ago without a hood, then you sew the eyelid shut. So this is an example of Mimi and her husband Don sort of geeking out on the ancient art of falconry. And they've only been in Colorado for a few months when they're doing it. So they're like diving headlong into this hobby, this practice, and doing something really extreme in order to be the best at it. And so to me, it's a very character revealing moment, because it shows you exactly the lengths they're willing to go through to do something in a distinctive way that makes them feel good about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That you could say that's why they had 12 children. You could say that's why they dressed them all the way they did and wanted them to be perfect. There's a lot that sort of flows out from that moment.
Yeah, I mean, it is the perfect telling detail of what she, not only what she would do and who she was, but, you know, there's just this edgy, not sadistic, but bordering on very uncomfortable, you know, who would do that sort of thing that ripples across this out of, you're right, kind of both geekiness, love, compassion, kindness, and yet something else. And I don't know if you can train yourself as a writer to find just the right. I mean, that one would present itself so obviously, I think, to most people. But throughout the book, you are just masterful at finding the telling details that tell you who these people are, which I think is another reason why amongst the 12 children, we never got confused about who was doing what and why they were doing it. Are there things you can say, or is it just instinctive of finding the keys into an individual's personality and what makes them tick and pulling those telling details out?
I think I really started to think seriously about this with my earlier book, with my first book, Lost Girls, which is about five women who are all caught up in the same murder investigation in the serial killer case. These are all women who were about the same age and they were on Craigslist as sex workers. And of course, I never met them because they were dead. And I needed to write about them in a way that made it seem like I actually understood them. And so I started by asking myself, well, why'd they all do it? Why'd they all make the very risky decision to go on Craigslist and become a sex worker? They all must have had a reason to do it. And the more I interviewed people and the more I learned about them, the more I saw that it was hard to get at an exact answer for each of them. So instead, I asked a different question, which was, what do they want? What do each of them want? What problem are they hoping to solve in their life? And that question was a lot more easy to get to the bottom of for each of them. And they all had different answers. That it turned five people who you could say were very much the same into five very different people with different things that they wanted. And so I think I went into that in Hidden Valley Road in the same way. You know, what makes Michael different from John, and what makes John different from Peter? What do they want? And I think that's what I kept in mind the entire time. What I understand from, you know, reading and listening to interviews with other writers is that if you can understand what a character, fictional or nonfictional, wants, then you can identify with them. Even if what they want to do is rob the bank, you know, or do something that you would never do, you'll spend the entire time going, are they going to do it? Are they going to rob the bank? You know, you're invested. So what they want became the watchword for me.
You're right. As you read it, so obvious that's kind of the lens through which you viewed this. So you had said that you turn a lot of stories down that come to you. And I'm kind of curious, as stories come to you, as this story came to you, what kind of elements, what are the essential elements that you're looking for to know that, you know, a story is going to work either as a book or, you know, even as an article, if you want to talk about that. But what are kind of the things journalistically that you look for?
To be clear, I don't say no because I'm choosy. I say no because I'm scared.
Gotcha.
You know, often it's because the subject matter seems so intimidating. And I think, what? This is about the stock market? Are you kidding me? You know, starting with Michael Lewis, there are 1,000 different people who do a so much better job writing about this story. What do I know about the stock market? And then I have to sort of hear about it four different ways until I start to think, well, yeah, I could dial into this. I could really do it. But to answer your question about what the ingredients are, there's a very, you know, basic what's news sense, because that's my training. I'm from weekly journalism. Ever since I was 23, I've been writing weekly journalism until I went into books. And so I think, well, what is news about this? What is surprising about this? What is dramatic and vivid about this? And so I am sort of sniffing things out in that way. But then more to the point, Are there two really, really good tracks to follow while you work on it? It's really wonderful when you have two things to think about. The first being the tangled tale you're telling, and then the second track being the bigger issue that's bubbling under the surface. So for Hidden Valley Road, it's very obvious. You know, it's the family story is a very tangled tale, like what's going to happen next to these people and what are their thoughts and feelings. And then the second track is, what is schizophrenia and what do we know about it? And what did we know about it then? And how wrong were we? And what can the Galvins teach us about it? That's the second track. So if there's any story to tell with two tracks like that, I'm really sold.
I forget, was their house literally on a road called Hidden Valley Road?
Yes. And and I can't take credit for the title. I mean, even when Margaret the older of the two sisters, was thinking about writing a memoir years ago. Someone said to her, you should call your book Hidden Valley Road. So it's been in the air since before I came around.
Such a perfect title. I mean, yes. You know, yet again, one of those gifts that just gets handed to you that resonates on a couple of different levels, which is so great. The other thing that occurred to me about journalism over fiction is, you know, most fiction writers that I talk to really don't have a reader in mind. You know, they're writing the story. The story has to stand on its own. Here, it occurs to me, I mean, not only do you have a whole swath of people, readers in mind, which is this family that are going to be reading it as you sit down at your keyboard writing every word. They're going to be reading it very critically. Did he tell my story the way I would have told the story, or did he do it accurately? And so that Greek chorus of very interested readers strikes me as being potentially oppressive to the writing process. And I wonder if you ever think about them, you know, while you're in the midst of writing. I'm sure you thought about it after it was done and you handed it to them. But do you let them kind of get mentally in the way as you're working?
It's a very serious concern, and it's a very valid concern. I don't want to belittle it when I say that it's something that, because I've been in journalism for almost 30 years now, I'm kind of accustomed to it as a problem. Like, I'm ready each and every time a story or a book comes out that the subjects will then have to grapple with it. So I'm sort of at peace with it as I'm working on it in a way that I might not otherwise be if I were 25 and working on it. I get it. I know that it's going to be hard for them, and I'm sensitive to them about it. And I don't see them as adversarial. I'm very sympathetic. I think, you know, it takes a big leap of faith to open your world to somebody else and to potentially be misinterpreted by them. And so I want to be a sounding board to them even after it comes out, to the extent that I can. It's a very, very hard line to cross, because I certainly do not want to cross over into advocacy. I mean, as I said before, I really feel like the finished product would be much more powerful as a work of journalism than as told to or as a work of almost ghostwriting. So I really want to stay on that line. At the same time, I want to be respectful and sensitive and non-judgmental to the extent that I can. So it's that's the sort of murky area that I'm in, and I'm kind of accustomed to it now.
Did you vet the manuscript with either the researchers and scientific community or with the family before it went out?
The science I was desperately worried about. So I have, you know, various pieces of it, chunks I sent off to different experts to make sure that I wasn't making huge, you know, mistakes in explaining what was going on. And there was a general fact checker to check to make sure that everything I wrote about the family checked against all my interview transcripts and everything else that I had from them. And then there were several different scientific experts that vetted the science. And then the family did see it a few months before it was published, because the media got advanced copies and places like People Magazine wanted to interview them. Mm. And so I said, well, I mean, I can't ask them to do interviews for a book they haven't read. So a few months before it was published, they all read it. And there were some, you know, little line corrections about street names and things like that, for sure. And they were worried. They read the book, and some of them liked it immediately and others didn't. Others thought, only saw all the bad stuff and thought, well, this is going to be exploitative. It's going to be explosive. And then, you know, thank goodness it wasn't received that way.
Lost Girls was turned into a movie. I don't know if there's any discussion of that for this book.
There is for a miniseries, but I can't claim that that's going to happen tomorrow. And also, I think it happens very, very often now with anything nonfiction out there, because there's such a war going on between all the streaming services that nonfiction books just get snapped up immediately as material for something new. So I'm excited to be involved in this one, and hopefully something will come of it, for sure.
I was going to say, do you work on that part of it? Do you do any screenwriting, or you're strictly book writing?
This will be the first time I'm involved in it. With Lost Girls, I was really happy with the team and really felt very lucky the whole way through. My role was strictly to be, you know, a cheerleader and maybe a resource if they needed to check a fact or two. But I loved their approach, and the people themselves I thought were great, and the finished product was great. I felt very, very lucky. And this time I thought, well, I've seen it happen once. Maybe I could be a part of it this time. So I'm excited about that.
That's fun. Do you have any advice for people that are going into journalism now, maybe younger writers or people that are making career changes? Like, do you feel that MFAs are important? Do you feel that just on-the-job training is important? Kind of Do you have any insights into the path in, or, you know, the most important things to have on your resume as a writer at this point for journalists?
I would think that unless you're a pundit or a memoirist who has a story burning inside you or a point of view that you're just dying to tell the world, my advice for you would be to be flexible and curious about different directions you could go, to not necessarily feel as if you could really predict what's going to work out and what isn't. That's certainly how I felt in my career. I'd get handed an assignment and I'd think, I'm not terribly interested in this. And then a year later, I would look back and go, wow, I'm really glad I did that story. I learned a ton. It made me a better writer. Now, when I do this story, I'm feeling much better about it. The excitement of journalism is that there is a low barrier to entry, that you can get to work on something immediately, even if it's small, and publish it, throw it up online and publish it yourself. And then suddenly you're a published journalist, and then the work keeps spiraling. You don't have to go to medical school to do it. And that part is exciting. And then, of course, the hard part is, how do you make a living at it? How do you build up the right kind of experience? How do you not spend all day tweeting?
Right. I love the, I just love the broad range, especially as I look across your resume of the broad range. I mean, you talk about CRISPR technology, so you're in the sciences, and obviously you're in the serial killing field, you know, so it's human stories, it's scientific stories, it's financial stories. And I should point out at the very end of this book, something that should have been obvious to me all the way along, but until it was pointed out to me, I didn't appreciate, is yet again, the class economic divide of people who have money would get better treatment and access to research and access to new technologies and help. Whereas, you know, this family was really trying their best to get these boys as much help as they possibly could. But yet again, another way that you can bring in the socioeconomic conversation, you know, to this family story as well. It strikes me that because you've done so much work across so many different areas of discipline, you could bring all of those to bear on this story and any other story that you do in the future.
It's true. I mean, the fun part of writing long is that quite often I don't know I knew it with this book, but quite often I didn't know whether it would be 80% just the narrative, and then 20%, what does this story mean and what issues does it raise? Or would it be the other way around? And you don't really know until the revision process and through editors and focus grouping, really among friends, like what's interesting here. But to get to your larger point about class, and the Galvins presented a really good opportunity to write about what happens when a middle-class family has an issue like this, because they were not insanely wealthy and they weren't in anywhere near poverty either. And their health benefits only went part of the way. And many of the sons are now wards of the state and lived in federally supportive housing. But on the other hand, there's a whole other story about the mentally ill in America that this book does not touch on. And that's the people who are in the prison to hospital revolving door, the homeless people. And then of course, minorities. There's a way that the mental health complex has almost sort of turned race into a mental illness in a really strange way, has been, particularly during the days of Jim Crow, found ways to disqualify Black people by saying they were mentally compromised. So these are things that are not in Hidden Valley Road that I could not touch on. So obviously no book can do everything, but I wanted to try and use the Galvins as an example of kind of a mainstream white American mid-century story.
Yeah, and the concept of eugenics and all kinds of biomedical ethics issues, it strikes me that it would be very easy to just keep pulling yourself off the track to say, this also is interesting. And by the way, this is interesting. And, you know, the discipline it would take to keep yourself coming back to this family, this story, this set of circumstances, and not, you know, let yourself get diverted and pulled away by all these other interesting strands, as you point out. I would succumb to that. Maybe that's part of the revision process, that you have to cut all that stuff out.
Yeah, and I'm a big believer in the kitchen sink first draft that has everything in it. And then, not to mix metaphors, but you look at it almost like the rough cut of a movie, and you say, well, what really belongs in this book? And then what will I have to redo considerably? I really feel like once the first draft is done, you're really only a third done. You're not really halfway done. And then you can, but it gives you like a ground to walk on, and so that you really know what has to happen to make the thing work.
How many revisions did this go through, would you say, or is it hard to count it that way?
I mean, everything gets revised like a zillion times, but there were two big manuscript drafts, like one big first manuscript and then a second pass that took months to do. But in those were things that my editor would see. But in that time, there'd be, you know, tons and tons of printing out and revising that would happen in between.
I can't even imagine. So you're pretty much everything stayed in the computer for you, as opposed to having stuff up on your walls and timelines on your on the back of your chair or something. Was it mostly computer driven?
Yeah, I didn't do note cards or push pins or, you know, a thumbtacks and bulletin board stuff. I had the most beautiful thing up on my wall. You know, Margaret, the older of the two sisters, is an artist and a really talented one. And one day I was interviewing her in the space in her house where she would do some of her artwork. And, you know, the sun's coming in and there's all the art stuff around. And in the middle, and we're talking about her childhood. And at one point I said to her, "Can you draw your street?" And she pulled out rolling paper, you know, this kind of rolling paper you put on a child's easel or whatever to draw. Mm-hmm. And she got out some colored pencils and she drew her neighborhood. And, you know, I got sort of the lay of the land to know which way was the Air Force Academy and where was the neighbor's house where they would go. And it was about like 3 feet long, maybe, and 2 feet wide. And so I rolled it up and brought it home and I put it up on my wall and had that while I was working on the book.
I saw on your website that people are visiting this house and your admonition, they are not there anymore. Don't go there.
Don't go there. It's just a house.
These poor people did not sign up for this yet.
They're really nice too. They're so nice.
It sounded like they were nice. I heard something about them. Oh, well, we've covered a lot of ground. Oh, so there something we should advice or insights or something that we should have said that we forgot to say or didn't say?
I sometimes think that because it on the face of it, it's a bleak story and it's so science heavy that it's intimidating. And I try to reassure people that, you know, to think of it as a family saga and that even independent of the stuff about mental illness, it's about parents and children. And it's about children growing up and reevaluating their childhoods and coming to terms with things that happened. And hopefully it's dramatic and vivid and compelling and inspiring in its way, because people are moving through the worst things in their lives.
It is all of those things. And I can tell you that I can easily put a book down, and I could not put this down. I should say I couldn't take the earbuds out of my ears, and my husband was constantly saying, you know, "Can you talk to me for a minute?" I'm like, no, and I can't. Well, it was really wonderful. Congratulations. And we can find you online. You have a website, and I know you have a lot of things coming up for the paperback tour. So there are other ways for listeners to find you. I think all of that's on your website. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. RobertKolker.com.
Wonderful. Robert Kolker, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Mary. It's a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for today. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.